We're back, bitches. That's right. Kicking the Karaoke, the intersectional feminist podcast, is back for season two.
You may have heard that we don't play it safe, as was mentioned in the Guardian article.
Back in January. Little cheeky hair flick there. And we are covering more topics, more people, and more everything badass and woke. I don't know if we could say woke though.
Yeah, I don't know. Someone will tell us. Which is a good point, actually. You can call us in if you'd like to. You can get in touch. We're all up for that, whether that be through Twitter or through Facebook or any other form of communication, including email. You can do that too.
Exactly. Because it's important to remember, if you're a first-time listener or a long-time listener, that we're learning just as much as you guys. We are on this journey as well, which sounds really wanky that I've just been like, oh, we're all on a journey. But, you know, we're learning. And so if there is something that we do that could be phrased better, or, you know, topics that we could be covering, or topics that we should have covered in a slightly different way or a different perspective, please let us know, because that's the only way that we're going to get better at this, and the only way that I guess society as a whole is going to better from all of this.
Yeah. And I like the idea that, like, our activism is ever evolving, that we're continually growing to become better people. I like that. I don't know if we can use the word woke, but I like the idea that that's a constant
goal.
Yeah. So let's tell us a little about how we work if you are a first time listener. We have three guests every month, and we cover one big topic. And what's really important is that we do everything on our guest terms. We fully acknowledge all our privileges as white women. So the way that we do this is that we interview them, they get to see all the questions, they get to listen to the editing. So everything you see and hear has been fully approved by the guests. It's on their terms, not on ours.
So you can rest assured that every narrative that you're hearing in this episode is not a manipulated construction that we've done to suit our agenda. This is something that everybody on this podcast has listened to and given their consent to and willingly shared their story. And I'm really proud of that.
Yes, me too. And actually raises a really good question. How many other media outlets do that? When you're reading things and you're trying to be critical, think about that.
What is the agenda of the person writing this, and how many clicks are they trying to get?
Yeah.
So, kicking the Karaoke. One question that we are guaranteed always asked.
How do you pronounce Kiriaki?
Yes, that's true. That is something that we
always
ask.
I always get asked that.
To be honest, I don't even know if we're saying it properly.
No.
But the meaning is there, Kiriaki. Do you want to quickly actually give a bit of a rundown of what Kiriaki is? Because we tackled it in the first episode, Privilege, which you should absolutely go back and listen to. But sometimes our podcast doesn't really work as a series. You can listen to each individual episode on its own.
So if we were to give you a basic introduction to Kiriaki, basically patriarchy is the oppression of women by men. So basically, Kiriaki is a more intersectional way of looking at it that way, because we are not oppressed only on the spectrum of gender, but also in terms of race, in terms of disability. And so that's the way of looking at it. The idea that we are all in a really complicated field of relationships that are constantly pulling and oppressing each other, which means that lots of people have lots of privileges and lots of people are oppressed too. So if I haven't lost you, everything is a lot more diverse and exciting and complicated than you thought it was.
So we're not just smashing the patriarchy.
We are kicking the Kiriaki.
Exactly. So yes, we are always asked that. But I was more thinking, we're always asked, aren't you going to run out of topics one day? And the answer is no.
No.
Because the world is pretty fucked up thanks to people like Trump and L'Oreal.
Hashtag we stand with Monroe. Monroe Bergdorf is a fantastic trans woman of colour who was recruited by the makeup brand because of their diversity campaign, and then subsequently dropped when comments that she had posted about Charlottesville had gone viral. And she was just basically telling the truth.
In inverted commas, what those inflammatory comments were that she said all white people are racist and that all white people benefit from white supremacy. And she's done a lot of work the past few weeks explaining that. And I guess, I mean, I don't want to explain for her. You know, there's lots of great resources and great videos out there that you should be watching her videos and supporting her work. But basically, the gist of it is that you might not be individually racist. You might not walk around discriminating against a certain person because they are black or they're East Asian or Southeast Asian. But the fact that you're white means that you're benefiting from a systemic racism. You're benefiting from the fact that people will automatically have a preference for you.
And it's not just about racism, because it's also about power. Who is more likely to be backed up by the state if you, for example, were to get into the fight in the street? There's this whole structure behind it, which means that it's not just about name calling. It's so much more than that.
So it's a fucking massive topic. And at times when doing this podcast and doing this episode, it can feel a little overwhelming. And to be honest, we kind of have the nice side of it in the sense that we're white. So we can choose when to dip in and out of race conversations.
Absolutely right. And this is why you should listen to this episode. You should listen to it, take everything that's said into account, and you'll learn a lot from it, because we certainly did.
So, race.
Yeah. I guess we better hand it over to our three fantastic guests and they will tell you more.
Boom.
Thanks for having me. My name is Sianna Bangura and I am a writer, a poet, a performer, a community activist and I suppose all-round busybody, agitator, shaking things up. That's what I do.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Could you maybe start us off by telling us what race means to you?
Oh my God. Let's go for it. But I mean, it's messy. That's for starters. So I think, what does it mean to me? You know what? It's weird because I think ultimately at this point, it's almost a meaningless concept that has real life meaningful ramifications for the people who are most kind of visibly affected by, I'd say. So obviously, I think the idea of race has changed a lot. I think it hasn't changed as well. I think that as well, there's an academic understanding of it, and then there's a kind of real life, everyday understanding of what it is. I think there's an activist understanding of what it is as well. But, you know, obviously, for me, I'm racialized as black. And again, we could talk about other things like political blackness. But because I'm racialized as black, that has real life consequences for me. And I would say one thing is really important, that I can't speak about race in isolation. It's not an isolated thing, that's for starters. So race is very much a part of a bigger conversation, right? And that's what intersectionality is. So as a black feminist, and kind of in terms of how I kind of understand the world, it's through an intersectional lens, meaning that I'm not just black, I'm a black woman. I'm not just actually a black woman, I'm a black woman who is working class and has a migrant history, but also a very privileged educational background as well. And then, you know, we could talk about things to do with kind of colorism and all those kinds of things as well. So I think, yeah, race is a really big part of my experience, but it's heavily intertwined with all of the other facets of my identity.
Right, exactly.
Messy.
Yeah. It's interesting that you identify as a feminist, because traditionally, white feminism...
Vanilla feminism, I call it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Has excluded women of colour.
Absolutely.
So are you able to kind of talk about your feminism and why you identify as a feminist?
Yeah, that's funny, because I think straight away there's another kind of word that would definitely suitably encapsulate my politics, which is womanism. But I think for me, I find womanism to be very, it feels very specifically African-American. You know, I don't really just call myself a feminist. I do more often than not say I'm a black feminist. I think it's quite important for me to preface it, just because for, you know, very good reasons, the word feminist still disillusions people. It's still kind of, particularly women of colour, there is a default idea of what feminism is, and the face of feminism would be more yours than mine, shall we say, right? But I identify as a feminist. I think I identified with it long before I really used the word. And I always say this, when I was growing up, I did not have the language at all. I didn't know necessarily or understand what feminism was, but I saw feminism in action all the time in my household. I don't think my mum would call herself a feminist, but I'd say my mum's a feminist. And I think I would say I come from quite a feminist background. A lot of women in particular from kind of African, West African households can say that. And again, there's a lot of contradiction there too, because we could have a big conversation about also those same women internalizing patriarchy and things like that. But I saw feminism in action and it didn't have to be called that. So I think it's really when I went to university that I started to identify with this term. But weirdly enough, it was really where I started to feel excluded. So we had a university feminist society, but I found it really racist, in all honesty. And really, it was things like, we had a Facebook group, and anytime you posted something about race, it was always like tumbleweed. But then as soon as someone posted something about sex, it was like a 1,000 comment thread situation. And it just got very frustrating. I felt very excluded. Really understanding the idea of intersectionality came from really feeling excluded from what was going on. I did a gender paper at university and it was all white, of course, but it was still a stepping stone for me to make a conscious decision to go and find voices like mine. So I then encountered, of course, our African-American feminist heroes like Audre Lorde and bell hooks and Patricia Hill Collins and Alice Walker, and I started to feel like, wow, like representation, but to a point. So then I understood, well, I'm not black in America, so there's something missing here. Clearly, you know, I need to look into our black British feminist history, right? And in all honesty, That was really hard to find stuff. You know, there's a lot of work, but I think that in terms of the documentation side of all of that work, it was just really hard to find it. And I think, you know, if you are looking for kind of black feminist text, then the canon would be very much American women's voices. And, you know, I didn't encounter the likes of Heidi Mirza and people like that, but then I then understood that Heidi is politically black, and I didn't really know what that was at the time either. And one thing led to another and just led to a lot of education. And founding No Fly on the Wall as well was definitely a massive point of education for me. I was just a kid out of university who just felt very frustrated and invisible. And I said, what am I good at? I'm good at blogging, and I'm good at, you know, galvanizing the masses, shall we say. So I just reached out to some friends and was like, I want to start this blog, let's do it. As my feminism developed, the concept of that platform developed more. So actually, I was just thinking about this on the way here. When we started, we had voices from like lots of different women, actually. But then I learned that it's probably important to have just the voices that are like mine, because we don't really have a lot of like young black women in Britain talking about this stuff. So yeah, it's been a bit of a journey, really, but it involved feeling excluded first and foremost.
Can you tell us a bit about political blackness? So defining as politically black, but then also what's the difference between that and being a person who's
racialized as black?
Yeah.
Yeah. Being politically black is essentially just not being white. There's a very important reason for organizing under that banner, especially historically, you know, in the 80s, the 70s, the 90s, you know, like even today, like POCs are apparently 14% of the population. And of that 14%, roughly 3.3 or something are black, maybe 4%. And so there's so few of us. So it kind of makes sense that we should all just like get together, right? Makes sense. Because ultimately, you know, we experience racism, but to different degrees, I would say. The problem, I suppose, that we're having now with this idea of kind of lumping everyone together, not saying it wasn't useful back then, of course, there were always people who weren't agreeing with the notion of blackness being the only or the main umbrella to struggle under. It's a term that I still think a lot of people who aren't organising in NUS, who aren't organising in trade union spheres, I don't necessarily think it's like a concept that a lot of people in general would understand. In my personal opinion, organising under things like political blackness, I just think that it doesn't necessarily give us room for honest conversations as people of colour about anti-blackness, which is something you find in POC communities and you find it in black communities as well. We don't get room to interrogate that when we are all kind of bundled together. And I also just have another problem with the idea of blackness just always being affiliated with struggle. Maybe it's a smaller point, but the way we use language is very important and interesting to me, because I'm a writer and a poet. And I think already in common parlance, anything to do with blackness is negative. To be in the black, for example, or to be blacklisted, or to be a black sheep. They're small ways that end up conditioning you to see black as wrong and white as right.
POCs for people of colour.
People of colour, yeah.
What's the difference between using black and people of colour?
There's an argument that we spend too much time thinking about that and not enough time acting. But I think, you know, it does matter. So people of colour, I mean, it irritates me to an extent. I'm not colouring book, but, you know, it's inclusive enough, and it includes brown folk. It includes people who are non-white, and I prefer it to being called non-white, because the other thing is we have to move away from centering whiteness. We have to move away from whiteness being the barometer that everything else is measured by. And I think when we mean black, we should say black. Why are we saying people of colour when we specifically mean an experience that is very specific to people who are racialised as black?
Yeah. You touched on the difference between the black American experience and the black British experience. And I feel like you can't ignore events like Charlottesville. That's just happened.
Yeah.
You know, police brutality in the US. I think people look at the US and are like, oh, racism is a massive problem in the US, but it isn't in the UK.
Absolutely.
What's your take? And I know that you've done that documentary, haven't you?
Yeah, we're working on it still, but I can tell you, yeah. I can talk more on that. So this is an interesting one too. So again, the experiences aren't the same, but there are similarities. And I think what British people are really good at doing is deflecting. Yeah, I think we are really good as a culture of just being like, other people are worse than us. One thing I always say is nobody in their right mind can say that the United States of America is not a racist country. You know what? It would be a really hard thing to argue. Even if they've had a black president, it's pretty tough to say they're not a racist country. Here, however, you can have a lot of convincing arguments. Even, you know, like white people can really talk to people of colour and almost try to convince them that it's in their head and that they're crazy and that, no, that is not racist. I'll tell you what racism is. Even though you don't know what racism is, really, you have not experienced that because you are the one in the position to be racist. So I find it really interesting here, like, it's all quite, you know, microaggressions and, you know, very insidious and institutionalized. And of course, I'm not saying it's not like that in the USA. Here, like, there are plenty of people who are still romanticizing, you know, the empire. There was this Guardian article that came out about a survey a few years ago, not even that long ago, and it was like 40-something% of people were like, the British Empire was one of the best things ever. And it's like very few of those were probably people of colour, you know? Probably very few of them thought that was good. Because of the education system and our histories and things like that, you know, like, there's a very superficial touching on the atrocities. And this is the other thing too, when people are like, oh, black people and brown people need to get over it. It's like, this is the problem. Yes, you didn't do it today, and maybe not even your direct ancestors, but you're benefiting from something that has happened, right? The empire, slavery, all those things are like the worst things to have happened to humankind. The reason being that we're still living with the direct effects of those now. This is why, like, the black community, for example, doesn't really have generational wealth. We, you know, are still working those things out because we're dealing with direct consequences of experiencing those things. People then do false equivalences. You just don't know your history. I think it's a very specific thing that's being done where we just don't know our histories. And so a lot of people don't quite understand the extent of what happened. And, you know, history has living consequences. All of this is still living history, as far as I'm concerned. So whilst, you know, certain demographics are more likely to live in poorer areas and have the worst schools and have, like, the worst access to healthcare and all of these things, we just have to understand that they're direct consequences of kind of the history of this country. And the UK is the fatherland of racism. So, like, I feel like what America did was like, yep, dad, I'm going to do this and do it even better than you. So, like, that's what we're witnessing now. You know, they learned from somewhere.
Was Charlottesville a surprise for you?
No. No, none of this is a surprise. Like, it could be anywhere. Like, Ferguson wasn't a surprise. Like, none of this is a surprise. And what makes me laugh, but it's not a funny laugh, it's just like when people are like, usually white people, in 2017, like, but we've been telling you this. Right. Why are you surprised? And I think it's really sad because it means you haven't been paying attention. And it literally takes actual Nazis killing people and killing white people too, for you to be like, oh shit, okay, this is real. And I think what's really frustrating too, for the most part, is, you know, people of colour, we don't have a choice. There are days I don't want to talk about race. Like, I just want to sit down and eat some ice cream, drink a mojito, but I can't because I don't have a choice in it. Like, these things affect me. But white people have a choice to just switch off, and mostly they just switch off. And when you talk about these things, I think a lot of people are more outraged by being called racist. They're not outraged by racism. Again, in the UK, like, there are so many people who think, like, racists are a particular type of person. So it's like, we're not those kind of people. And actually, you know what, like, for the most part, it's really controversial to say, but to an extent, all white people have the potential to be racist, or are racist already, actually, because of just the way society's conditioned. Even black and brown people internalize those things. Some of them have negative views about their own communities because we internalize that, like, white supremacy. So we're all susceptible to it. But you have to come to that point of acceptance for you to unlearn. And we don't have that. There's too much defensiveness. And even people like me, I know I get on people's, like, nerves. And even people in my community, they're just like, why are you always talking about this stuff? And it's like, well, you know, we have to. I don't want to, but we have to. And then you've got white people who are like, oh, well, not all white people, hashtag not all white people. And it's like, firstly, if you have to say not all white people, there's a problem, because clearly if you're not that person, I'm not talking to you. However, you probably know who I am talking to, and what you need to do and what people need to do is really take on board this active allyship. That is something that people who are, in inverted commas, good white people, who are our friends and our colleagues and our comrades, and who really mean well, but ultimately, like, there needs to be active allyship where you're not just firstly sitting around and expecting POCs to educate you, because there's a lot of privilege and entitlement in that. Also, you're not doing the thing of speaking over them, and, like, you know, there's that too. But also, you have to confront your peoples. It's really, like, not my job to have these big conversations with, like, other white people, really. In an ideal world, I should be just really concentrating on the very big job of working my own community dynamics. You know, we've got a lot of things going on that we need to sort out. But unfortunately, I have to spend a lot of time educating white people, and I have really, like, cut a lot of that out of my life now. But you do encounter it sometimes, and you feel compelled to be, like, the voice. But yeah, like, you know, again, you always get people saying, I didn't ask to be privileged. Well, yeah, duh, but you are. And it's also like, the great thing about privilege is you don't even notice that you have it because it's privilege. So it's like, when you do that amazing work of like understanding that you have that, guilt is useless. I don't want your guilt. I need you to do shit. So that means, like, if you have money or access to space or like networks and stuff, use that stuff and make sure that people of color and other people organizing that space have access to those things. Like, if you're able to donate, then keep places like Common House open, for example. If you're able to organize space for, you know, black feminist groups to get together, then like do that and just help to redistribute the resources, is what I'm saying. But most importantly, confront other white people. Don't let casual racism just be ignored. Don't just sit there and be like, at the end when the person's gone, oh, wasn't that terrible? I think that's so British as well. Just don't be a hypocrite. Like, I think we need more white allies with a spine, basically, who are like going to actually speak up. Not speak over, but speak up. And I think a lot of white people find it hard to confront other white people. And this is what we, like, that's the next step. It has to happen. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck where we are.
It's fucking amazing.
Everything I was like, let's ask what a good ally looks like. And then you went there.
I went there.
Yeah. It's brilliant. I don't know what to ask.
Have you ever internalized racism?
Yeah. Yeah. Firstly, let's just get this clear. So the word racism, right? Okay. So obviously you had to learn this. So obviously people just think racism is, oh, I don't like you, racist, the end. Okay, people of colour can't be racist because racism involves structural power. So again, there'll be people, I don't know if they're listening, maybe the people listening to this will like get this, but there might be a few who trickle on and think, oh, what is kicking the kiriaki? I'll listen and be like, oh my God, no, I've experienced racism from black people before. No, you've experienced prejudice because it's very unlikely for a black person in this country, and really in the West, to be honest, to be able to make sure that you don't have a home and that you don't have a job, you don't have food and that you will be arrested or whatever just because of your skin colour. We don't have that power. So what it is everybody can be prejudiced. So have I been prejudiced? Oh, yeah. But racism is a specific phenomenon, okay, that is white people being racist. So got to put that out there. But anyway. So, yes, I've internalized anti-blackness. I really did. I used to be really ashamed of kind of saying this, but it's part of my journey. And I think it's also very important to say it, to be like, even me, I can reach the point where I understand and overstand all of this shit can be undone. Growing up, I didn't really like being black, to be honest. But I didn't start off that way. But it's something that developed because I felt very rejected by the black community. The black community that I was sort of a part of. And essentially, you know, being called things like a coconut, an Oreo biscuit, a Milky Way bar, any type of food, like just being called it because of like the way I spoke and the boys I dated and the music I listened to and like being vegetarian and an atheist and just all these things that were, in inverted commas, unblack. But obviously we know there's no one way to be a black person. That is very clear. But I guess growing up, I was called a lot of those kind of names at school. And it just made me just be really like, well, fuck you guys, man. I don't need, like, you call me white, I'll be white, even though clearly I'm not white. So I really, I really struggled with that stuff. And I didn't really talk about it that much, even to like my closest friends, because I didn't really have the language. I just knew that black people that I knew got on my nerves, in all honesty. And I think I just felt really judged as well. And I think I just felt really misplaced. There was definitely like a moment when I kind of stepped out of that, and that was going to university. So it happened pretty late in my life, but I went to Cambridge University, and I have always said this, if I didn't go there, then I wouldn't have had to confront my blackness, and I wouldn't have then started No Fly on the Wall, and I wouldn't be sitting here today with you guys. So having gone through most of my life being told I'm not black enough, right, I was then put in a position where I was the representative of all black people. And I was like, this is shit. Like, I'm not even a good representation, apparently. How am I going to, like, represent the entire bloody race? For a long time, you know, in my first year, for the most part, I was basically the only kind of black girl on campus, shall we say. And it was just really weird. And for the most part as well, you know, at that particular university, the stats are pretty low for people of colour anyway, particularly black folk. And I actually, again, was really that person who was like, I'm not joining the ACS, the African Caribbean Society, because why do we need to be friends just because we're all black? So I really shot myself in the foot from what I could have had in terms of like a community. But I did, in my final year, finally realise... I need my people. So I then, you know, actively kind of made an effort with the ACS, and I was one of the founding members of an organization called FLY, which was started by three girls who also thought that like the women's society was just not very representative at all. So all of that was really important to me, and that was like a really key milestone. It was a process, and that entire process happened through the duration of my university experience. So I went from being not black enough to being like the black girl. And it was weird because, I mean, prior to that, even though I had my struggles with my community, I was known for lots of other things. At least I had the pleasure of like having other facets to my identity. But I felt at university, I was very much essentialized and really just like the black girl.
You went from being, I guess, not...
in inverted commas, not black enough.
Yeah, and like also not visibly black person.
Yeah.
To them being...
hyper-visible.
Hyper-visible.
Yeah.
But do you think in general... do you think black women are invisible in society?
Mm-hmm. I'll really break this down too, because there's nuance to this. So I think black women are in an interesting position in society where we are hyper-visible simultaneously as being invisible. We're hyper-visible as a group that is essentialized, stereotyped, and as, you know, black women are angry and hypersexual and ugly or baby mamas or all of that stupid stuff. But then we're also invisible as individuals with nuance, yeah? So I always say that. So for me, again, I was hyper-visible as the black girl, but I was invisible as Sianna Bangura, right? So that's I think that's like an experience that we all have, especially when we're existing in such white circles. And then I would say, in terms of nuance thing, I think it's really important here to talk about colorism. So just to explain that, that is the kind of essentially hierarchy of people, but usually of women, depending on your actual tone of skin. One thing, again, white supremacy is excellent at is that it doesn't need white people to propagate it. A lot of people of color do that work. So, you know, again, like the lighter you are, the more, in inverted commas, European features you have, good hair, in inverted commas, that kind of stuff, you know, the less invisible you are. Even though there's so few kind of meaningful representations of us, you know, in the media, if you do see us, it's usually a specific type of black woman. So she will be kind of your Beyoncé's, your Nicki Minaj's, your Rihanna's, and I love them. But you know what I mean? They kind of tick certain boxes. Increasingly, we are seeing more of the Lupita Nyong'os and people like that. But again, a lot of it feels still very tokenistic, you know? So yeah, black women kind of exist as hyper-visible as a group, and everybody thinks they know us, but we are invisible as like individuals with like individual dreams, individual experiences and individual tastes and all of that kind of stuff.
It's really interesting. On Twitter, I've seen more people use GIFs of black women showing expressions than actually platforming the voices of black women with retweets.
Absolutely. Like that. That's so interesting you talk about that, because I shared recently, I wish I'd written this article, it was excellent, but it was this article, it was about the digital blackface thing. So again, and you know what, even I hadn't really thought of that, like really, I'm always learning, and I was like, you know what, that is so interesting. And this writer really wasn't talking about black people using these, but I was like, even me as a black person, I'm going to really think about my use. Because you have people who probably have no black friends, but they're forever jiffing black people like Wendy Williams, and they don't even know who she is. How are you using Wendy's tea, but you don't know who she is? Just paraphrasing the article, one section I thought was powerful was them saying, well, you know, black people are your joy, your sass, your pain, your indifference, your whatever, whatever. But you just still are not like writing for black people. People out there, like, go and read this article. I think it was in Teen Vogue, which is doing the most. Teen Vogue, about digital blackface and how, yeah, black people, you know what, we're hyper-visible being performers, caricatures, and just being that kind of thing for everybody to use, and less visible as like people, but we're also hyper-visible in our pain. Like, people are very used to seeing videos go viral of us being shot by the police, right? And being beaten up and having our wigs ripped off or something like that. I think people are quite numb really to that point of almost seeing black people as just human.
So Rachel Dolezal.
Oh my God, must we? Go on then. Go on then.
I mean, can someone be
transracial? Okay, yes, you can be transracial, because it's a real thing. It's a very specific experience of like kids from one race being adopted by another race. So everyone can go Google that and look it up. I'm definitely not the person to educate you on that. So transracial is a thing in a very specific context, and that context is usually like adoption, yeah? Out of that specific context, no. So long as I can't wake up one day, friends, and say, you know what, I feel white today, and I'm a white man, and I'm going to use that white man privilege, or I'm a white woman, I can't can't do that shit. So there we go. End of story. I'm going to always be black, so you're going to always be white, I'm afraid. There we go. I just feel like there's not really much else to say. What people should go and do is, you know what, Ijoma Oluwo did the good work for us, the work of the good Lord, and she went and like interviewed Rachel, who is trash, and did the last ever interview with her, and it was excellent. And anything you need to know about that woman is in that interview. So go and read Ijoma Oluwo's interview with her, and then go and read her work that has nothing to do with fake black women. What I would say as well, though, the very fact that someone feels they can do that is interesting, because nobody feels like they can be like politically brown or feels like they can just kind of feel white or whatever. Like, even mixed race people who are half white, but for the most part, they're still often going to be racialized as black, yeah? But what's interesting is that so many people can feel like an affiliation with black culture. And so many people love black culture but don't love black people, right? Love the music, love the style, love the this, love the that, love the idea of black men having big penises and stuff like that, right? But do not then speak up when black men are being killed by the police. They don't stand up like when it's time to talk about Black Lives Matter. Instead, they're out there with hashtag All Lives Matter. So I just think it's interesting that, you know, a lot of people can feel like they can really chip in and insert themselves in inverted commas, kind of the notions of black that they want. I have to really develop this concept a bit more or whatever, but I was really thinking about how blackness, it really doesn't mean anything though, because it's not attached to a location. And that is the idea of displacement. We are black, so that's not necessarily being Sierra Leonean, it's not being Nigerian, it's not being Jamaican, it's not being anything. It's just this idea, it's actually a colour. Whereas it's harder for people to say, oh, I feel Indian, or I feel Nigerian, or I feel this, because those things are really specific to a geographical location, which then means it's rooted in a specific culture and experience. And so I just think that's something too, this idea of, like, I talk about it a lot, this hybrid substitute identity of blackness, of black Britishness. It means it's always something that can be taken away at any point. So if you are a good immigrant, all of a sudden you can be, you know, Sienna from Southeast London. But if I did some shit, I'd be Sienna Bangura, originally of Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting that these identities can be taken off, given, borrowed at a whim.
You've already told us what active allyship looks like.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you had any comments about white defensiveness and what we can do around that.
It's a good question. And again, I'm giving all these articles to read because I've found them interesting too. There was an article I read, can't remember the writer's name, but it was basically in summary about how do you accept that you have white privilege when you've grown up poor, like really poor. And for me, I found it so profound because I was like, wow, you know what? And I'm talking from someone, I didn't grow up poor like that at all. This is a white person who grew up poor. And they were like, how can I be expected to even consider that I was given some kind of white privilege? But the essay was really fantastic because it started off with all of that and then obviously coming to this realization at the end that, you know, it's complicated essentially. So I'd say if people can just like do their Googles and find out that essay, that was profound. But defensiveness. So, you know what? I have privileges too, guys, you know? And I think there are times where, you know, and I'm really thinking about that too. Like, I'm able-bodied, for example. I'm cishet. So much privilege in that, right? And all these types of things. And then, you know, obviously, like the way I speak, and, you know, even being from London to an extent, and all those kind of things. It can be hard when you don't have privilege in other ways to then see your privilege. And it can be really upsetting because without necessarily wanting to be, you are complicit in other people's oppression. And that is a very profound realization, and it hurts, especially if you like you love black people, you love brown people, you have them in your life. I'm not doing hashtag black friends, but just as in, like, it's not even a thing. Why would you not have them in your life? For you to then understand that actually there are elements of my own existence that are oppressing these people, it's tough. But I'd say, like, however shit you feel, man, can you just for a moment be like, well, okay, I feel bad because this is my realization. What is it like to be living that? I think that's the question you have to ask yourself. I think it's something we can all do better at, like really actively understanding and doing the work of empathy. So not sympathy, empathy. There's a difference. The idea of like really trying to remove yourself from your own kind of position and try and put yourself into other people's shoes. And it's so like cliche, but that's the first thing. Like, it's about perspective. And I just think, like, the sooner people do that, the better. I think the sooner that people stop being upset about being called racist and then like making people who call them racist like be the instigator, the bad guy, because you end up being the bad guy all the time. Just rechannel that energy and all the guilt and the white tears, like stop with that and actually start like really being practical about stuff. I just think that things will be better. So if you're feeling defensive, boo-hoo, man, like get out of it, snap out of it. If you really are about that life, then start being about it. Because you know what? Again, another article I read, which was really great. It was actually in context of Adele and Beyonce and the Grammys, right? And mate, I love Adele. I don't care what anyone says. I love Adele and I think she's absolutely sincere, yeah? So I didn't read it the way other people read it. But what I would say is for a split second, I thought she was going to give that Grammy away. I really did. When she said, I can't accept this. And I was gonna be like, Adele's going to, no. And she didn't. And it was like, okay, but then again, I guess why should you? Why should you? Because that's sacrifice. And it's about, that's a really small example of what it looks like, yeah? So the other thing is too, I'm just going to say, I don't really think Beyonce would have wanted her to just give her the Grammy. That's another convo. But this idea of sacrifice, all of this stuff takes sacrifice. It takes self-sacrifice. Yeah, sometimes it means that you have to say no to stuff you really want because ultimately, if you start doing that work, then maybe we start to break down these systems of privilege. It really takes removing yourself from being the center of your universe, because a lot of white people, for the most part, like, you haven't been taught to not be the center of everything. Because if we're using language like non-white, and if we're using things that emphasize that whiteness is the barometer of humanity, whiteness is the default, and anything else that deviates from that is other with a capital O. If we've been taught that, then how can you even begin to look at the world differently?
I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know, that we've taken a lot of intellectual and emotional labour from you. you're a black woman, but you're also a creative. And
yes,
we've had you on to talk about race, and there's so much more about you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So how can we support you? How can we find you? And how can our listeners find you and support your work outside of being a black woman as well, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, ultimately, everything I do is as a black woman, so I wouldn't want to divorce that. But I just don't think... I mean, the key thing is that it doesn't need to be said, because that's what I am, so that's always there. And I think you make a really good point about how, example being, this year I've been really pissed off. Reason why is obviously Black History Month's coming up, right? Now, I'm a working artist the other 11 months of the year too. And actually, to be fair, you know, March is Women's Month, so I get that too. So March and October are like my busy months in the year. But even this year especially, it's been extraordinary how I haven't heard from people really. And all of us, you know, March came and I was inundated, and now October's coming and my inbox is blowing up. But I'm kind of like, where are you guys the other 10 months of the year? It really pisses me off because it's so tokenistic, right? Support people in a really meaningful way, okay? Like, you know, so the stuff I'm doing, I'm working on a film about police brutality. That's coming, like, when that's out towards the end of this year or the top of next year, support that film, 1,500 and counting. Come to our screenings and stuff like that, okay? By the time this goes out, the fundraiser would have ended, I think. But, you know, I organise in a space called Common House, and we are seriously under threat of closing because of gentrification. So, again, like, become a friend of Common House. Like, go on the Common House website and join us and help other activists from across the kind of board in terms of walks of life and demographic and stuff. We're organising to make sure that marginalised voices have spaces to organise in, okay? Buy my book, Elephant! You know, it's out there. Go buy it. I hear it's a good book. Go and watch Denim as well, my film. It's on YouTube. Go on siannabangura.com and enter my universe and you'll see all the cool things I'm up to.
Thank you so, so fucking much for coming on to this podcast. Like, honestly, we appreciate
it
so much.
It's cool. I appreciate it. And, but I only just, like, remembered this, I'm one of the artists involved in the Black Blossoms tour. So my friend B Tajuddin is awesome. And she's founded, like, this arts and education platform called Black Blossoms. And they're on tour now. And we've got so many great Black, British, female creators. And Denim's going to be showing in Liverpool and, like, other places in the UK. So come out there, go and support.
That was Sianna, and she gave us a lot to think about in terms of resources we should be using and reading and what a good active ally looks like. You follow her and support her work all year round, not just every March and October. Next up is Ming, talking about the British Chinese experience.
I am Ming, full name is Wei Ming Kam, but most people know me as Ming, and I am cis and bi and British Chinese.
Thank you so much, Ming, for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
The podcast. Very excited. We both, Sid and I, have read The Good Immigrant, mm-hmm. and we love the whole book, but we particularly liked your contribution to it. So we're very excited to have you on this month. So, jumping in at the deep end, just going to get straight into it.
Okay.
Ming, when did you realise you were Asian?
The term Asian is actually... It's very broad and it differs. So in the US, when you say Asian, they generally mean Asian American. And for a lot of the USA, Asian American means in their head, like East Asian, so people from China, Korea, Japan. But even for the USA, like, it's not supposed to be like, it didn't like originate as like a broad umbrella under which like ethnic groups are supposed to be underneath. It was more of a political coalition. So Asian America is very broad, and actually, like, I kind of think it's ridiculous, because actually it's supposed to like encompass East Asians, South Asians, Southeast Asian people, and to a certain extent I think it also sometimes includes Pacific Islanders as well. So it's incredibly broad, and it's definitely supposed to be more of a political coalition thing than it is supposed to be a group under which like ethnic groupings are supposed to be. So that's just for the US. And then over here, it's more like referencing South Asian people, so Indians, Pakistanis, Bengalis, etc., etc. And I guess that's, in my head, that's definitely more a case of like government sort of imposed a term, as it were. Because if you look at anything to do with like the census, or if you know, like workplace diversity, you'll always see quite a broad range underneath Asians. So it would be like Asian/Pakistani, Asian/Indian, etc. And then everyone else is like tick other. So it's either like Asian or Chinese, and then everyone else is other, essentially. And that's partly to do with like the history and the demographics of Britain than it is the US. So that's really broad, but that's basically like the differences between like the US and North America in general, actually, and Britain. So when you talk about when we talk about, oh, when did you realise you were Asian, that's partly influenced, I think, by, like, American culture. I also know exactly what people mean when they say, when did you realise you're Asian? Because what they're actually saying is, when did you, like, first realise that you're Chinese? Which is to say, pretty early on. I mean, like, there are always these, like, the idea of, like, being, like, a certain way, or when people think that you are Chinese or like Korean or Japanese, there's definitely expectations and stereotypes that you are aware of from very early on in Britain. When I was talking to Katie in The Good Immigrant about that, you know, both of us are very aware from a young age that people have these certain expectations of us because, you know, I am Chinese and I look Chinese, and she was half Vietnamese and she kind of looked vaguely Asian-ish. You know, the expectation is that we are extremely smart, probably in maths and science, and that we would always work hard, and that we would always like be top of the class, and we were good and, you know, subservient and quiet and blah blah blah. So the answer is just from a very early age.
Those stereotypes, do they still follow you today? The ideas of being hardworking.
Oh yeah,
and good at science and maths, and
oh yeah, definitely. Like, that's definitely, if you just look at like pop culture, do you know what I mean? And the way that if we appear in the news, which is to say very rarely, it's nearly always to do with like education. Also, it's either education or like criminality. Rarely, it's always like someone is a doctor, or they're a scientist, or they're a businessman, or they're like some sort of faceless villain in Iron Fist or Daredevil. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Those expectations are very much like shaped by pop culture. And they hold strong still even today. I mean, if you go back to like Fu Manchu, for example, it's an incredibly racist stereotype, and then it had massive influence on like things like Doctor Who. And it still follows us around.
This is a massive topic, and there's there's literally so many different angles. Yep. and questions and things that we can go for. And the reason why we're particularly interested in it is I don't think that this podcast has ever really done justice to an East Asian and Southeast Asian narrative. And that's partly because, like, I was never really educated on it, and then when I was, you know, learning about experiences of people of colour, I feel like I was always like taught about it from a black perspective. And then I moved into a new place, and my housemate Amanda, she's Chinese, and so, and we were like chatting about it, and it's like, where are these narratives? Like, why do these narratives for like East Asian and Southeast Asian perspectives don't exist, or why are they really difficult to find?
I mean, again, it's partly like the very different like demographic and historical perspective that Britain has from, say, the US and Canada, for example. So they have a much bigger Asian American population. Please bear in mind, again, that it's a very broad term. Whereas over here, you know, a lot of the pop culture and history that we get taught in school and then actually appears in culture itself is the Black British experience or the British South Asian experience, which is not something that, like, I object to at all. That's literally just, like, the way that things have happened. And we have a much smaller proportion of British Chinese people in the US compared to the overall population than, for example, like, there are Asian Americans compared to the overall population in America. So there's, I think it's partly, I do think it is, like, partly, like, a demographic thing. But then, you know, there's also just, like, racism and the fact that historical narratives have always been, like, erased, because partly because of that, that continues on into the way that people perceive East Asians in British culture today.
Can you tell us a bit about the model minority narrative?
So this is an idea, again, like a lot of racial, like, historical and sociological perspectives has been shaped very much by Asian American research. But basically it just means that it's not a label that a community calls itself. It's definitely always something that is given to a particular, usually racial group, by the government and society, essentially. And what it means is that these are the types of people that you want to come to the country because they always, quotation marks, they work hard, they make sure that their children go through education, they are mobile, like, they are mobile in terms of, like, class, they're aspirational, you know, they work in, like, really good jobs. They are the types of, like, immigrants you think a country would want to have. So in America, a lot of the time, that's Asian Americans are, like, the modern minority. And when they mean Asian Americans, they always mean Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, usually middle class when they come over to America anyway, which makes it obviously easier for them to move upwards. And over here, I kind of feel like that's a similar narrative for the British Chinese in particular. And I really feel like that's a harmful stereotype in many ways, because when you say model minority, who and what do you mean by that? Who's a model minority? Why are you calling them model minority? Why are you saying that these people are the ones that you want to come into the country? And I kind of feel that actually it's a code for being on perpetual probation, because, you know, they could take that away from you at any time for whatever reason. I definitely feel like, I talked to some people from the British Chinese Project, and they're basically an organisation which is working to make the British Chinese more politically engaged, because we have a very low, like, political engagement rate. It's like, well, I think something like 30% of us just aren't even registered on the electoral roll. And they were very clear in saying that they definitely felt it was something that a society imposes on a particular group. So I feel like it's harmful because it's used as kind of like a political weapon against other, like, racial groups. So when you say something, someone is a model minority, you're saying that everyone else is not a model minority and that they should aim to be like this group. Otherwise, they're not the type of immigrants that you want. And model minority, when you say that, you usually mean it, or the government or society usually means Black people, or, you know, as of at the moment, anyone who vaguely looks Muslim is not a model minority. So I really feel like that is the main, like, most harmful use of the model minority stereotype, is using that against other communities. It's a divide and conquer tactic, essentially. But it is also harmful for those who you're calling the model minority themselves, because you assume that they are all exactly the same, they behave in exactly the same way, they all have the same kind of, like, aspirational views, that they all basically are an entire monolith, which is not true. As I went through in my essay, like, yes, there's, like a high level of overall economic prosperity, but then when you actually look at it, we also have, like, for the British Chinese anyway, you also have higher levels of poverty. We are not all the same, like, our concerns and our issues are not all the same. And if you treat us all like we are absolutely fine, we're the model minority, then it means you're not dealing with any issues that need to be dealt with, like high levels of poverty, like the fact that a lot of families are isolated in towns and may suffer from racism that the police ignores, for example. So it's harmful for a lot of reasons, and basically it's because it's a divide and conquer tactic.
What was interesting, you mentioned about how like British Chinese people are very like politically disengaged. Why is that? Is it?
So there's a number of reasons, really. With every sort of wave of immigration from like Hong Kong to then Chinese people from British colonies like Malaysia, which is where my family are from, people have always the British have always been very hostile to us. Basically, going into any industry apart from things like laundry and food and so on, and so obviously that's changed a lot. But at the same time, there's still like a fairly large proportion of like British Chinese people working in the food industry and so on, and that usually means like long hours that people can't be bothered or think they don't have time to go and like register or to vote. Then there's also the language barrier. If you talk to a lot of like elderly British Chinese people, them a lot of them are not very good with English. You know, this sort of thing goes hand in hand with the fact that the British government has never been really very good with providing resources for immigrants of any kind to transition into British society by providing translators as well as English classes and so on. And then there's also the fact that obviously there's hardly any British Chinese or even British East Asian, if you want to broaden it out, politicians. They just don't feel represented. So there's a lot of different reasons, basically.
Right.
Historically and demographically.
Do you think that British Chinese people or British East Asian people feel protected by the government? Like, do you think that they could easily, you know, call the police if they were to be like burgled and be taken seriously or something like that?
I don't think by the government. We definitely have a kind of like a privilege, as it were, amongst like ethnic minority communities, because we have that model minority stereotype of being we're good and we're hardworking and it's fine, as contrasted with, for example, the stereotype of black people. I think we have to a certain extent a kind of privilege when dealing with authorities like the police. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that police deal with us in the same way like they would white people, for example. Like, there's a lot of like indifference when any East Asian or British Chinese people report racial harassment to the police. Like, the British Chinese Project brought a report to Parliament about the interaction of the British Chinese community with the police, and I think something like 43% of people who had dealt with the police said that they did not feel reassured, and some of them even felt like intimidated after like they reported instances of racial harassment. And that can lead to something like, in the most extreme example, Miguel Hong Chen being murdered in Wigan in something like 2005, 2009, I can't remember exactly what year. And that was very clearly a case of racial harassment, which they had previously reported to the police, and the police just dismissed it completely. So it's mixed. I feel like we do have a certain kind of privilege compared to other racial minorities because of the stereotypes that each community has. But on the other hand, there's also a lot of police indifference as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about yellow facing, what it is?
This is such a broad topic. Okay. I mean, I think it's always happened. But then what we have now is social media. So basically, I think just Hollywood or, you know, cultural media, Western cultural media in general, has always had a history of erasing Asian experiences from the screen, either by getting white actors to put on yellow face makeup, aka, you know, like they will do makeup with their eyes and then, like, you know, put a slightly different, like, hue of makeup on them to make them look vaguely Asian. And then there's also whitewashing, which is basically like there was a role which is Asian, but then they bring in a white person to do it, and then they just never mention the fact that it's supposed to be Asian. It's just a white person playing an Asian role. But then there's also just like different tropes. So it's either erasure, or there's like pop culture being really fascinated by Asian cultures and then going over and being like the white savior. So they'll construct stories in which they go, look, this is a really cool culture. We're going to pick out the best bits of it and like make up a new story around that culture. But we're going to make sure that the hero of the story is a white person who goes over, learns all of the things about the cool culture, and then is better at the culture than the actual people who the culture comes from.
When we sent you some questions, you mentioned Orientalism.
Oh, yeah, no, that's... So that, again, that's a very broad topic. And basically, it comes from an academic book by Edward Said. And it's about the idea that certain cultures, when, you know, Westerners or European cultures encountered them, feel to them fascinating. But then, like, the way that they view it and the way that they consume it is very othering. It makes them feel like a very sort of alien culture, you know, almost inhuman, as it were. So Orientalism is basically like the way that people view what Western society would call Eastern cultures.
I'm very conscious that I think we've been like quite theoretical. What's something that, you know, that you've experienced, that you've had like firsthand experience of this, if you have at all, or something that, you know, that you deal with, whether you have to overcome in like your in the workplace or anything like that,
especially something that maybe Elena and I would have never ever had to think about?
I mean, this isn't unique to like Chinese people or East Asian people at all, but like when you're in a very white dominated industry, there's not very many of you of like as an ethnic minority within the workplace. So sometimes like you're going to get the whole mistaken for the other person despite looking nothing like them. So this isn't unique. You know, I've had like friends who are black or South Asian in publishing who've texted us in the group chat and been like, you'll never guess what happened. They mistook me for the only other like black person in the entire company. But like that has happened to me. Like it's not, as I said, it's not exclusive to like Chinese or Asian people at all. But then, you know, that also occurs when... that also plays into the stereotype of all Asians look like each other.
Right.
So,
do you think that people just need to get better at knowing the difference between, like, what Chinese people look like, what Japanese people look like?
I think it's just people just need to stop being racist and pay more attention. It's not about, like, the difference between, like, a Chinese or a Korean or a Japanese person. Like, it's the difference between people as, like, individuals who just happen to, like... in their eyes share the ethnicity even though they may not. It's people just need to stop being racist.
And I guess you probably get asked where you're from a lot. Is that...
Yes, yeah, yeah. I worked in the call centre in New Zealand for like 7 months, and every time I'd spell out my name they would be like, is it Meg? And then I'd be like, no, it's this Ming, and they'd clock on that it was someone who wasn't white and was probably Chinese. And I get quite a lot of questions of like, where are you from? Oh yeah, no, my wife's from there as well. And I'm just like, that's really not relevant. Can I get off the phone now? So there was this one instance where this guy was just like, oh my God, my wife's also from Malaysia. And I was like, why did I even answer that question? And he got her to come over to the phone and just be like, look, you guys can chat. And I was like, no, I just want to get on my job. Goodbye.
No. So how can we be better allies to this?
Yes. Something that happened in the media recently, and I mean, I don't get offered acting jobs often, but there is that actor who declined a role in a film because it was actually...
Oh, yeah.
So his name was Ed Skrein.
Skrein? Skrein, Skrein, something. Yeah. I have mixed feelings about this. So,
oh, okay.
No, I mean, like, kudos to him, because with the caveat that not everyone is in a position to, like, give up money or opportunity, but in my opinion, like... Saying that you're an ally doesn't do much until you do something, and usually that doing something means giving up money or time or opportunity, in my opinion. And so, you know, when white actors often they're always just like, oh yeah, no, at the moment a lot of them are just like, oh yeah, no, representation is important, it's really important. Like Finn Jones said that before he took on like the role of Iron Fist. Like, that means nothing, because you took away a role from what could have been an Asian American actor's role. And so kudos to him, to Ed, for actually giving up an acting opportunity and money and so on, because the potential to get backlash from casting directors and producers and so on is great. But at the same time, it's basic level decency. Like, he is a white actor. He's already been like the lead villain in like Deadpool, for example. Like, you know, he may not be become a superstar, but he'll certainly be working like regularly for the rest of his life still. And yet after that, so many people have just gone, I really want to work with him, I'm going to give him like special roles and stuff. And I'm just like, really? Like, sure, he did what like not a lot of other like white actors did, but that's the bare minimum. Like, why are we falling over ourselves to give him extra work for just doing the bare minimum? I don't understand it. And it's because like standards for like white decency is so low. It's true. Like, we just, when we do get that kind of unselfish, I'm going to step down and do that and actually give up an opportunity, it's what everyone should be doing.
Just what you should be
it's
doing.
Just what you should be doing. I think the other thing is that people should just shut up and listen, basically. There's just so little willingness to really be quiet and just listen to what people of colour have to say when it comes to their experiences, to what they feel could be done to, you know, overturn things like white supremacy, or making like a business, for example, more inclusive, or, you know, or decolonizing an industry. There's just such an unwillingness for people to just be quiet and listen, basically.
So what are you working on? How can we find you? How can we support you? How can our listeners find and support you? The floor is yours.
So I'm currently working on an essay for a book of essays about intersectional feminism, which is being edited by June Erica Dory and being published by Virago, and it should be out next year, deadlines willing. My essay is about the impact of the immigration system on gender discrimination, or gender discrimination within the immigration system, but focus on very specific things. I'm also the co-founder of BAME Publishing, which is a network for people of colour who work in publishing. And if anyone is working in publishing and has not heard of us and they would like to come along and they're a person of colour, then just go to BAME in publishing, all one word, .tumblr.com/FAQS. And that should answer all the questions. And we also have the instructions for what to do to join the group, which is basically there should be like an email address there that they can email us with asking if they can join up. And basically they just have to send in their name and job and company. And I've also just helped to co-found Pride and Publishing, which is a network for queer people in publishing. So our first meetup should be at the end of September. And basically, if people want to join up, if they're a queer person who works in publishing, they have to email prideandpublishinguk@gmail.com, name, job, company.
Amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It was really lovely to hear about everything that you've been working on, and BAME and publishing and Pride and Publishing sound fucking kick-ass.
So that was a really interesting discussion from Ming around the nuances of being British Chinese and not just Asian. I think this is something that we could all do better on, particularly this podcast, for example, educating ourselves around East Asian and Southeast Asian narratives and culture. And a good place to start is definitely 100% reading Ming's essay in The Good Immigrant. Up next, Kim.
Hi everyone, I'm Kimberly Orr Kim, and I write a column for Galdem about race and love and everything else, and do some work with Consented, and I'm really excited to chat today.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on to our episode about race. We feel like it's really important, especially as two white women who strive to be intersectional feminists, that we approach this topic. So we're really delighted to be platforming this kind of conversation, I guess. So I'm going to begin with a super easy question. What is race and what does it mean to you?
Okay, well, race is a social construct. It's not real, but the experience of it is very real. And I remember the first time I ever found out what race was, and it was when I was on study abroad in Toronto, and we're doing an anthropology module, and the lecturer, who was just really smart and really on it, was just like, race is a social construct. It's an invention from the Enlightenment. It's not a real thing, but it's so entrenched in Western thinking that people perceive it to be real. So it doesn't matter that it's not, because your life experience will dictate that it is, because people think that it is real.
So when you say race is a social construct, do you mean as in like this idea that there's a physical difference between white and black people?
Yeah, like, for example, this one guy that I met on study abroad believes that black people are like psychologically predisposed to violence, biologically. Not me, because I was different, obviously. And it doesn't matter that there's no scientific evidence to prove that. If someone believes that that's the case, then it's going to affect your life.
It's almost kind of similar to the idea that black people can't swim.
Yeah.
There's nothing to it. It's just a product of white supremacy.
Yeah.
To be blunt, really.
How is race an intersectional feminist issue?
I guess when I always think about intersectionality in general, I always try and think of it as what kind of ways of thinking in our society. So if Republican Joe thinks that black people are predisposed to violence, and he believes that because of some historical reason, and then he works for a FTSE 100, how does that way of thinking, plus the power that he has over other people's lives, so who gets employed, who doesn't, who gets a promotion and who doesn't, who does that exclude, and who does it benefit, and who has power and who doesn't? Intersectionality is about investigating all of the people that are excluded for one reason or another. Your gender can also exclude you in the same way. When I think about race and gender intersecting, it's like a unique experience in itself. So it's not that you're suffering from racial discrimination and then gender discrimination separately. It like compounds to make this like whole new unique experience. And the way I've heard it described before is like, if you put copper and tin together, you get bronze, which is like a completely new compound, which is completely different from the previous two ingredients that you put in. You don't get tinper. And so the experience in itself is something new and unique, but not necessarily in a great way.
What might Elena and I, as two white women, never have experienced?
Right. Never being the default. There's really minor things like a skin-coloured pen when you're colouring in at school, to being in a photo booth and you always come out kind of grey looking, just because the lighting is always set for the default, which is a white person. But then to like more serious life-altering things, to being in public space and knowing that like if you tweet an opinion, you're going to be attacked for both being a woman and being black.
Kind of going a little bit veering off right now, you write a column for Galdem about race and love.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I have an ex-boyfriend that hates me profusely now, but I started writing it because I was with him, I don't know, for like 2.5 years or something, and we broke up and it was fine, but then a few of us went back up to Manchester where we'd studied to hang out. And we were in this bar and he was just talking about how where he worked, people were always saying racist things and sexist things, but he never really did anything about it. And he went to Moss Side Carnival and people were being racist to him. And I was like, well, they weren't, because you're a white man. Like, that's not what racism is. The whole conversation ended with him being like, well, I never really found any of that stuff that interesting. And then I was just kind of like, wow, like I was with someone for 2 years that doesn't think that race or racism is interesting enough to think about or to try and tackle. That's my whole life. Like, I don't really have the luxury of being able to not think it's interesting, because it dictates my entire life. He wrote me this huge letter from India where he was finding himself. And you can't make it up, like 100%, like with monks or something, or was it nuns? I don't know. But like, it was like eat, pray, love, all the stereotypes, anything you could imagine he was doing it. But yeah, he just wrote me this like huge treatise from there. Just like, it always annoyed me that you always looked at everything through the lens of race and gender. And I was just like, well, what other lenses do you want me to look at it through?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't really know. And then I just put it online.
What I find interesting about, which I hadn't thought about when we were thinking about this episode with race, was race and love. And how for me, as a woman and as a very outspoken intersectional feminist, I can find it sometimes difficult engaging with men and like wanting to be with men, because I'm like, inherently, I dislike you. Because inherently you are a misogynist. Like, whether you want to agree with it or not, you're a misogynist, because that's the way society has unfortunately conditioned you. And to all the guys listening right now saying to themselves, but I'm a nice guy, hashtag not all men, like, you're a misogynist, accept it. The sooner you accept it, the sooner that I can be with you. And
public service announcement.
You admit it, I can be with you and love you for it. But anyway, and what I find interesting is that I find that annoying and frustrating, but then you have that added identity of men and white people and whiteness. And so what's that like? What's your experience of that?
To be honest, it's a fucking nightmare. This is what I realised after all of the nonsense with my ex-boyfriend, was that it's already hard enough to find someone who self-identifies as a feminist but then actually lives those principles, like isn't just chat, has similar interests to you. Like, it's hard enough finding someone who you just find interesting. So if you've already got that to deal with, that's pretty hard. So even if you found someone who also then is a feminist, then after that part, you've got like all of the race stuff. Then you've got to deal with the people who like fetishize ethnic minority women. And then on top of it, you've got to either be educating people or dealing with microaggressions. And it is just an absolute ball ache. And then you just get really exhausted. I'm taking a little break from dating white guys, but it probably won't last very long. It's like 85% of the population. So
there is a real point about emotional labour and having to... And we completely appreciate that as two white women, we've invited you on to talk about race. And on your point, Elena, about men being misogynists, then we also have to accept if all men are misogynists, then as white people, we are inherently privileged and racist, I suppose. I guess my question is, what does being an ally look like? What should the right guys be doing?
The white guys should be mindful about some of the things that they might say. Go and read up on things. Also, just because you fuck with ethnic minority women, like, doesn't mean that you're a hero or you're not a racist. Listen to podcasts like this. Google stuff. But don't expect the other person to have to do it if they don't feel like it. And I think that really links to just being an ally in general. If I say, actually, I just don't want the conversation to continue, it's too much, because for them it's just a debate. And like, for me, it's just my whole life. So it's just, they don't have the same relationship with the discussion. But also in those situations, like, other people, white people, have stepped in to then like have the conversation on my behalf. It saves me having to put in the work to do that. So I've always found that really useful, like someone else just coming in and like having the argument for me. And then giving people platforms, definitely, as well. And just checking in on people.
Could you talk to us a bit about what structural racism looks like? And that's quite a broad question, but because I think we probably haven't really ever had to think about it personally.
Yeah, I think structural racism is difficult because it's so hidden and it's so long term, and it's based on like 400 years of like colonial history and government policy, and it's really, really hard to communicate. And I always think like an example of what isn't structural racism, which is just like general racism versus structural, is racism just generally would be when I went to my friend's house and I drove my car there and I left it there, and then the next day when I got up, like, the police had been called on my car because an old woman had called the police and said my car was abandoned and put a sign on it and then came out to shout at me when I went to go and move my car. Like, that's, it's not a great day, but that's like a direct incident of racism. But structural racism is a lot more insidious rather than as overt as that. So if you have a Muslim sounding name, like, the fact that you have to send in three times as many job applications is a result of structural racism, because there's like 400 years or so of colonial history there. There's more recent like pathologies around like Muslims and their behavior and who they are, and you're suffering economically because of that. And that's based on a complex history and the way institutions are run and the way you're portrayed in the media, and they all conflate and intersect, and that's affecting your outcomes, like in employment or in education. But it's so hard to communicate that because it's complex, and it's a lot easier for people to understand racism as something that happens because an individual is bad and they commit a crime against another individual because of their race, if that makes sense.
People that say that they're colourblind.
Oh my God.
Is it a thing? Can you be colourblind?
No. Particularly because so much of racism is unconscious as well. And so like the way you perceive people is based on like unconscious processes in the brain that you don't even notice. So you physically cannot be colourblind even if you tried. So that's already like strike one, no. But equally, it's just not helpful for anyone. Like, I wish we lived in a society where we don't have to think about race anymore. We don't have to talk about it. Like, it doesn't impact people's lives in every way. But we haven't gotten there yet. And until we have, it's just not helpful. It's like a misrecognition for me and everyone who looks like me and our lives, because I don't get the luxury or the privilege of pretending that race doesn't exist. If someone else does, it's not only just irritating because you're like, that's annoying, something's happening to me and you're pretending it isn't, but it's also really dangerous because we have some serious problems. Like, if someone's having to send in three times as many applications, we need to be able to talk about the fact that that is linked to someone's ethnicity. And if you just say, well, I don't see race, you also don't acknowledge that issue, and then we can't even try and solve it if we're pretending it doesn't exist. a colorblind approach is only helpful when we reach our idyllic post-racial society, which I hope one day will come. But until it has, being colorblind is really, really unhelpful. I'd say it's kind of destructive and counterproductive. And also, it's not even viable because unconsciously you're probably still making loads of assumptions about people based on their race without even realizing that you are.
Do you think a post-racial society is possible?
I don't know. Like, right now I don't feel confident in it, but equally you have to, without that hope, like, it's just really difficult to continue. So I think there almost needs to be like a slightly delusional sense of optimism just in order to like continue to fight for it as an ideal. And I don't know, like, the life I'm living right now is still miles better than my ancestors. So the leaps we've taken is not enough, but we have made some strides. And I always like to point that out because there's never enough good news about anything. But I am skeptical about whether it can be achieved, but I have to hold out the hope that it can. Otherwise, it's hard to continue like working in this space.
What does taking steps towards post-racial society look like? So, for example, job applications that don't have people's names on them,
yeah,
so that they'll be anonymous. And I guess kind of hand in hand with that is the idea of like quotas, I suppose. So thoughts on that?
I'm a fan of all of those things, like name blind those CVs, like straight away, panels with like at least one person of color on it, or, and like definitely like at least one woman if you can, all up for quotas. But they're definitely like not, they're politically suicidal still in a way that it isn't for gender. So people can talk about gender quotas and, I mean, men will still go batshit about it. A lot of the turnaround with people understanding that maybe it would be the only way to end gender inequality in the workplace is because people can understand the issue more because everyone has a mother, or more or less, and a lot of people have sisters or an aunt or a daughter. And so when they think about what they want for them, they want a society where they have equal opportunities. And so then when you come to them and say, we need quotas, it doesn't sound as jarring. But because we haven't gotten to a place with race where, well, one, know that there are inequalities, and two, understand why they exist, people don't understand why we would need quotas. And so people just think it would be playing favour to people who don't have the right skills, rather than seeing it as hiring people on potential because they haven't been given the same opportunities and they've been held back in ways that like white men haven't, and just trying to rectify that imbalance. So I think the only way to truly rectify that imbalance would be quotas, but it's a hard sell because people don't believe that racism as much as an issue as it is, and they think it's just the result of like a few bad individuals that like beat people up in the streets. They don't see it as something that's like entrenched in our economic system. So it's a pretty hard sell to even get to the quota stage before you even get to the like post-racial society stage.
It must be frustrating to look at events like Charlottesville and have people be like, oh my gosh, you'd never realise this was 2017.
Oh my God. And it's like literally like every ethnic minority was like, I'm not surprised. Like, this is not shocking. The same with like Brexit and hate crime. And people were obviously horrified and shocked that there was all this hate crime post-Brexit and it was seen as totally shocking. But it's just not shocking to ethnic minorities because these issues have existed since like at least the 1950s, well, longer than that, but in a similar fashion since the 1950s. And we've not spoken about it really. We've not dealt with it in a public way. We don't teach colonial history really at all. So people don't even understand that Britain had an empire and that it was extremely brutal. People are very nostalgic about it. They did a YouGov poll. Everyone loves it, thought it was great. So that isn't, if people don't understand that any of those things have happened, but we do, and then of course it's shocking for them because they've never had to engage with it before. And so I can see why it's a surprise, but it isn't a surprise for us. It's still very upsetting, but the causes of it have been very apparent for a really long time. There's not been a concerted effort to teach people about the past and then try and come up with something new that brings people together that we can all be a part of. And I think until we do that as a country, like, we're not going to get anywhere, and neither will America.
Kind of taking it back a little bit, when did you realise that you were black?
So I remember when I still didn't really think about it, because my mum always made me very aware that I was black, so there was absolutely no way that I was not going to know about it. I think just she didn't want me to be surprised or unprepared for when the moment would happen. So she just thought, I will continually tell you, but there will be a moment when you realise. It didn't happen for a really long time, because I remember my mum showing me two photographs, one image of me at an event at an after-school club I went to, and one on a school trip, a school walking trip in the countryside. And she asked me to describe what was different about one photo from the other. And she said, and so I was going through saying, in this one, everyone has a backpack. In this one, everyone's in their summer clothes. And the only thing I didn't realise was that everyone in one photo was white, apart from me, and everyone in the other photo was black. And I must have been like 11, maybe. And it didn't occur to me that that was, yeah, one of, now that'd be the first thing I would see. Like, there's absolutely no way I could miss that, like, even if I tried. And I think that says a lot about growing up in majority white environments, and that for years and years, I was just shielded from the worst, like the sharper end of racism, really, because I didn't really have to think about it in a huge way. Because when I was six, basically, I got this random scholarship to this like fancy, really like fancy private school in the countryside. And so I just went from like my local school to just like all like rich white people, but like really rich. And I just living on a council estate in Reading, just being a child. But it did mean that like I was both acutely aware of race all the time, but then didn't really have to think about it in any serious way. But then I guess when I really realised that I was black was when I went to, someone was having an end of year party to celebrate, I don't know, something, when I was still at the prep school. And we had it at someone's house who had like a pool and tennis courts and was like very, very rich. And my mum had told me, just when you're there, be careful, make sure you're never anywhere on your own, and make sure, don't go exploring, because like if anything happens, if anything goes missing, they will blame you. So I didn't do those things. And then when, I don't know, something broke or something, and the like mum came down and was just like, who like did this, blah blah blah. And it was for the first time, she didn't like point at me or anything, but like it was, and it's really weird because you can't describe it, but like you just know. And I could tell, like, this is a person that doesn't like me for no reason. You can just feel it. And like once it's happened, you can never unsee it, and like it just never ever goes away. So I think it would probably either be then, or when this kid said that my mum looked like a monkey, who then got detention. But I think, and he's probably like a really nice guy now, but what it mostly shows is like the attitudes of the parents, because where do you learn that language from? At home. And so it's those kids, I don't know what he does now, but like there's every chance that he might not hold those views anymore, but his parents definitely do. And I think once that happens to you, then it never goes away and you can't unsee it. And you never forget it. Like, I've not thought about any of those things in years, but now you've asked, like, they all come back. But even so, like, those comparatively, like, other people have it so much worse. It could have just been way, way worse. And, like, that was probably, like, dealing with those things was worth all the privileges that I got from being in that environment, which still benefit me right now in a myriad of ways, like, unbelievably unfair ways. So I always like to put that in.
Yeah, it's interesting that it demonstrates perfectly almost, you know, how you can have privilege in one area, but then also be discriminated and oppressed in other areas. So, wrapping up, what are you up to? How can we support you? How can we platform you? The floor is yours. You know, if we want people to follow you, support your work, how can we do that?
Okay, so if you want to help out, definitely anything Gal Dem does, read it, watch it, and particularly read my dating series Woke Men Only, where you can hear about all the white men I've dated and all the future white guys that I will date, although I'm taking a break. And yeah, I hear about how it goes, which is probably quite badly, but I hold out hope for the future. But yeah, if you want to help me out, definitely read Woke Men Only.
Amazing. I kind of want to do a whole series on that, to be honest. That sounds great. Amazing. Thank you so much, Kimberly.
That was Kim. She was chatting to us about dating, her experiences as a woman of colour, and a lot more. You should definitely check out Galdem, which writes plenty of fantastic articles from women of colour.
And particularly around the British experience of being a woman of colour, which is, I think, something that isn't given enough time, not necessarily just about being a British woman of colour, but just the people of colour or POC experience in Britain. There's a lot of resource and a lot of time dedicated to being a person of colour in the United States of America, but not so much in the UK, which is why we kind of started this podcast, was to try and find those nuances. And, you know, I was sick of researching things and it always coming up with things happening in America. It's like, I can't relate to that.
Yeah, let's celebrate intersectional feminists right here in the UK. So we've got a couple of book recommendations for you, so you don't rely on the people of colour in your life to justify and explain everything. Our first one would be, of course, The Good Immigrant by Nukesh Shukla, with 21 authors talking about being an immigrant in the United Kingdom.
And the second one is the amazing Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Reni Eddo-Lodge. She is also in The Good Immigrant, so she's doubly fantastic. Not to take anything away from the people in The Good Immigrant. Yeah. They're also all amazing. But Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race is a fantastic book, and it's literally just been recommended by every single person we've spoken to. So if you're going to do anything this weekend or this week or this month, or spend your money on something,
then support women of colour and support writers of colour.
Exactly.
For myself, I haven't read a book from end to end for the past 7 years, and both of these books, Elena and I, have both read, and they're freaking amazing, cover to cover.
I'm quite proud of with us. We're not academic feminists. We haven't studied this. I think sometimes you can get lost in like academic theory.
And we know that the important thing to be a good ally or to understand anything isn't necessarily to read lots. It is to do your own research, but it's also to listen. Which reminds us, why don't you tell us what you thought of this podcast? It's our first one of season two. You can get in touch. Let us know what you thought. You can get in touch over Facebook at Kicking the Kyriarchy. You can email us, kickingthekyriarchy@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter at KickKyriarchy. You can visit our website, www.kickingthekyriarchy.org. We've got forms on there that you can fill out to suggest. Wow, forms sound so boring. We have pages on there, or ways that you can contact us on the website, where you can fill in a form to let us know of any suggestions, calling us in on things, so maybe we could have done something a little bit better. Suggest guests and topics. We're always looking for new ways to do things, or even, you know, if we could revisit topics, let us know. Get in contact. We love hearing from you.
And if you'd like to be our ultimate faves, give us a rating on iTunes and leave us a review.
Thanks, listeners.
Yeah, thank you, team. It's been great. Thanks, Elena. Thank you, our guests.
Thank you, Sid.
Aww.
Roll on episode 2.
Whoop, whoop.